This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is our week in review program for September 11th, 14 years since the terrorist attack in New York that took the lives of over 3,000 Americans. Each week, our writing and news watching staff produces a report called the Trumpet Weekly, and we look for the most important news from around the world. We try to steer clear of the fluff and the distractions and the nonsense, and we spotlight what really matters. The main criteria that we use is, does it fulfill end-time biblical prophecy? If you have any interest in prophecy, your alarm bells should be ringing constantly about what is happening in the world today in terms of how it aligns with the events, the trends, and the conditions that the Bible said would be happening right in the end time. The cover story of this week's edition is an excellent article that our own Richard Palmer wrote called Europe's Immigration Crisis, A Clash of Civilizations. And this article talks about how this huge story in Europe right now is ramping up this age-old religious tension between Catholic Europe and the predominantly Muslim Middle East and these refugees that are flooding there from the Middle East. It is accelerating the timetable for a religious clash between these two regions. It's really a modern version of the Crusades. And this is something that we at the Trumpet have been talking about for decades because of the prophecies of the Bible. We're seeing these prophecies move toward fulfillment in a dramatic way. Now, that is the story on the cover of this week's edition. You can have this report for free by visiting thetrumpet.com. If you just look under the subscriptions tab and you click Trumpet Weekly Report, it's absolutely free. You can get it each week in your email inbox, and it really does keep you abreast of what's happening in your world. Now, for the top story on this program, we're going to go in a slightly different direction. On KPCG.fm, we've been covering this refugee crisis in depth from multiple angles for several weeks now because it is such an important story, but in the interest of showing that there are, in fact, other important developments happening in the world, we're going to look elsewhere and to discuss what else is happening in our world. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff. We have Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in the UK.
Good afternoon.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
So to be perfectly upfront about it, our top story today is actually related to the immigration crisis, but we're going to look at it, one of the sources of the problem, and we're going to see what is happening in Syria. There are hundreds of thousands of people who have died in the 4+ years of Syria's civil war. No one knows for sure how many. There have been hundreds of thousands of killed by the regime of Bashar Assad, and this conflict has generated 4 million registered refugees in the Middle East and beyond. It looks like there have been several times where it's looked like Bashar Assad has been ready to go for years, and yet somehow he's clung to power, and now he's getting extra help from a very powerful outside source. We talked about this a little bit on last week's program, but to tell us more about it, we're going to pitch it to Brent, who has his eye on the Middle East.
Yeah, there was a Reuters report that came out earlier this week that did confirm what we talked about last week about how Russia had started to send troops, military equipment as well down into Syria. They have a naval base we talked about at Tartus on the coast there, the province of Latakia. And they've had that naval base there for a while. It's mainly a supply base, but it looks like, and the Reuters report came through, and then the Russians confirmed it as well, that they have actually sent troops there. Now, the Russians say that these troops are mainly advisors. They're not actively participating as ground forces with Assad's army, but There have been a lot of reports from on the ground that no, in fact, their Russian forces are being used alongside Syrian forces. Now, there was even a report that came out a couple of days ago from an eyewitness there, Ruslan Leviev. He's a specialist in social media intelligence, and he's saying that the soldiers that are actually appearing there, not the advisors, but the actual soldiers that are on the ground, a part of the 810th Marine Brigade, which is actually based in Sevastopol, Crimea. And these troops were Russian forces that were instrumental in the taking of Crimea back a year and a half ago by the Russians. And it seems that that same special force is down on the front lines helping out Assad as well.
So Crimea is in the bag. They feel pretty secure in that part of the world, and now they're ready to move on to other projects.
Yeah, it's the choice of which military brigade to go down there kind of shows that they are forward thinking, that they do intend to put more boots on the ground to help Assad. So it is something that we're watching in a very specific way. We haven't seen Russian forces in the Middle East fighting, actually taking up arms for decades, it seems, and they believe so importantly in this mission that they're willing to, in a way, blow their cover of who they're actually supporting and go down there with putting boots on the ground. It shows, as we talked about last time, just how precarious a situation the leader of the Syrian regime is in right now, and that Russia is willing to blow their cover. And even it shows, as the report brings out, another report in the Trumpet Weekly shows that Russia is willing to line up with Iran to fight with Assad as well. So we do have a real convergence of an alliance here in the Middle East that we knew was taking place in the background, and even, you know, they did vocally support the regime. But now both Iran and Russia are willing to submit troops to the cause inside Syria.
Why is Russia so intent on preserving the Assad regime?
We've talked about this a little bit, that they have that warm sea naval port, their only one in the Mediterranean there on the coast of Syria. So they need to make sure that whoever is in charge of Syria can allow them to use that port. There is some, I think they're renting a base in Cyprus at the moment as well. But this is their only one that they've got, that's Russian land, I guess, that they're have full control over. So that's important for them as well. Probably one of the most important things. The Russians are always looking to expand their influence, especially in a territory where the United States has been dominant for the past decades. In the Middle East, through the 60s, 70s, and even into the 50s, you had this Cold War playing out inside the Middle East, where the Russians supported Syria, they supported Egypt against the United States and their main ally in Israel. And it was scary a number of times through the 60s that this could have been a spark for the Cold War, what was taking place. Now, since that time, through the 90s, since the fall of the Cold War, you had the United States fully taking over the reins as the police, the police keeper, the person that organized and made sure peace took place inside the Middle East. And now with the United States on the way out, Russia is determined to get involved in the Middle East so that it can be the power player there.
Knowing just what a problem this area is, especially for Europe, it is interesting how Europe is going to be pushed more and more. And to think that Russia is in the mix, that it would change the dynamic between Europe and Russia. It's just an interesting dimension to this whole story, even though it's playing out in the Middle East.
It certainly is. I think it's part of the same story. It's no coincidence, I think, that today marks the first day since a year and a half of fighting in Ukraine that there was not a single shell fired. Poroshenko, the leader of Ukraine, came out and said that. And then what did he say? He said, well, it's probably because the green men of Russia are down in Syria. They feel like what they've done in Ukraine is enough for now, and they are extending their reach and putting troops on the ground in Syria. Now, you have to think about this from Europe's standpoint. I mean, you've got, what are Europe's problems right now? We've talked about the Ukraine and what's going on with Russia there, but also this immigration crisis. And Russia, if they're acting in their own self-interest, they wouldn't be too quick, or they wouldn't mind that this refugee crisis is completely distracting Europe. And, you know, I'm not saying they're necessarily happy with it, but they're not going to step in to try and stop this refugee crisis from happening as it strengthens their position.
Well, you almost wonder how much that would factor into their calculus in putting troops on the ground there.
Right. And that's just another point as well. I think our listeners and a lot of the world for the past year and a half have been distracted by the rise of the Islamic State. While we have talked about that as being very important, what we've seen here is that who really, like you said at the beginning, who really contributed most or has contributed most to the refugee crisis? It is not the Islamic State. There were millions and millions fleeing Syria before the Islamic State even came around because of Assad's regime. And now Russia is going in there, and what are they saying? They're saying that we should have boots on the ground and support the Syrian army if we want to defeat the Islamic State. But we need to remember that they don't necessarily care too much about the Islamic State. They are there to support Assad's reign, and taking rid of the Islamic State is not going to stop the refugee crisis.
Just thinking about how many other nations there are committed to what's going on in Syria, you know, you've seen more willingness to step up and to confront Assad from Turkey, from other nations. Eventually, the way we view it, Assad isn't going to last forever, and we're going to see a break between Syria and Iran. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out with as much outside material committed to that region. What's going to happen in the months ahead? It could get more and more explosive the more you see this develop.
Right. I think we are looking for that. We're looking for Europe to somehow get involved. And as this crisis escalates and even Russia gets more involved, it would change Europe's calculus to whether they would go in there. If Russia wasn't there, you'd think they'd be more energetic to go and stop and bring about regime change. So it's going to be a big decision for them when they finally make it.
Obviously, a huge story in the Middle East, but there were a lot of other significant developments as well in this region. Can you give us some other important Middle East headlines?
Just a couple of stories. The first relates to a poll that was released earlier in Israel this week, and it was a poll taken by the West Bank Palestinians, those in East Jerusalem in particular, and just a couple of interesting stats that might correct a bit of a view, what the Western media paints as a terrible situation created by the Israelis. The first one is that 52% of Palestinians living in East Jerusalem would actually prefer to live under Israeli rule than in a Palestinian state. So that's just flies in the face of what we hear, that the Israelis are beating down the Palestinians, that they can't get a leg up. And yet you have at least half the population of East Jerusalem saying, no, I would choose to live under an Israeli than Palestinian leadership. Contrary, well, in a way, on the other hand, there was about two-thirds of people polled in East Jerusalem said that they would encourage a violent takeover of Jerusalem itself, and that of those people, most of them sought alliance with Hamas rather than the West Bank faction of Fatah. So you do have that the everyday Palestinians possibly siding more with Hamas than Fatah, and that's what we've talked about that in the past. Just one other thing here, we had the French that said that they were going to start reconnaissance missions flying over Syria. They announced that on Monday. And then one other thing, we had the Austrian president becoming the first head of state to visit post-deal Iran. He led a delegation of 200 of his businessmen, and they're going down there to find what money they can make after this deal goes into effect.
Amazing. So the top story for the Middle East, Stephen Fleury talked about it extensively on his Trumpet Daily program this morning. But if you could just quickly bring us that top story from the Middle East, aside from the one that we've already covered.
Right. Well, the other one happened yesterday, and it looks like on the Senate floor, didn't even have to come to a vote, but because they wouldn't have had them, it looks like the Iran deal will not be hung up by the Senate. They needed two extra votes to force at least President Obama to veto the law that was, well, the review of the Iran deal, and that didn't even happen. So it looks like the Iran deal from the U.S. perspective is going to go forward. This is, you know, we've been talking about this since it took place and halfway through July, since it looks like they agreed, the world powers agreed with Iran. And then it went to the United States Congress for a period of 60 days for review, Congress and Senate. And just as that 60 days is about up, it looks like it's going to sail on through. Now, the New York Times, they had this to say of it. It said, Mr. Obama is likely to go down in history as a rare president whose single biggest foreign policy and domestic achievements were won with no Republican votes, a stark departure from his 2008 campaign that was fueled by the promise of bridging Washington's yawning partisan divide. So you had this huge deal. People are calling it a treaty there. The government is, you know, trying to play down that's an actual treaty. And what's happened here is he hasn't got the support of the American people. Over 60% of the American people do not agree, according to the polls, with the deal. More than half of the Senate and Congress do not agree with the deal. And yet, laws are such that this deal can go forward.
That is an amazing collapse among the opposition and the Republican leadership in Congress. It's just remarkable. I mean, there was no question that it was going to go through after they had already given up their power of putting a kibosh on this deal earlier on by changing the rules of the voting for something like this. But to think that they weren't even able to bring it, I think over the course of the time that this Congress has been in power, the Republicans have had a majority. Within Congress, they have only, I forget what it is, that President Obama has only used his veto maybe twice or something like that. They just are absolutely unwilling to do anything that is contrary to his will. They don't want to rile him up for some reason. It's just an amazing lack of leadership in Congress and their willingness to use their congressionally mandated power for the benefit of the country.
Yeah, just looking forward, just to instruct and inform the readers, the big question is now, well, how does the deal move? The deal isn't just involving the United States. It looks like the agreement will then be formally adopted by world powers and Iran after this review, which was going to take place 90 days after the July, when they came to the agreement, and that's on October 19th. That's when Iran and world powers have to start taking steps to comply within the agreement. Now, that means Iran's got to do its removal of certain stockpiles. It's got to clear up what we talked about, the past military dimensions of their program with the IAEA. They've got to do all of this, apparently, before cash starts flowing, before the $150 billion that we've talked about is unfrozen. They have access to that. And people say that that might take up to 6 months. So it doesn't look like they're getting cash tomorrow, but this was the big hurdle that had to be leapt over if this deal was to take place.
Meanwhile, through this entire process, Iran has not abated in its violent rhetoric against Israel and against America at all, not even a little bit. I mean, they haven't backed away. In fact, there was the report, it's in this week's Trumpet Weekly, from the Ayatollah, where he tweeted that there was some talk about how this makes it so that Israel won't have to worry about Iran for the next 25 years. And he said, they're not going to be around in 25 years. If God willing, the Zionist regime will be eliminated within 25 years. And he's made similar type statements. We don't want to deal with America anymore at all. Just very strong statements, trying to undermine any sense that there's any real reconciliation with the United States. It's a pretty remarkable backdrop against the people who are celebrating in Washington the fact that this deal has gone through. So thank you very much, Brent. You've given us a lot to chew on there. We're going to turn now to Richard over in Europe. Richard, can you give us the important headlines from Europe this week?
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to mention immigration for the just for the summary. It has really pushed the news agenda this week. In general, Eastern Europe has been very hawkish on immigrants, and Hungary has been holding military drills to practice keeping them out. And their prime minister said that the EU should be able to send the military into Greece to help keep them out there. And then even German Chancellor Angela Merkel's turning a little hawkish. The CSU, her sister party, and that's where people like Edmund Stoiber and Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg come from, they've actually been quite critical of her policy on Syria. And so she's being forced to move to the right a little. She's still been very open about welcoming Syria's refugees, but only 20% of refugees in Germany come from Syria, while 40% come from the Balkans. And so she's really cracking down on the Balkan immigration. Then meanwhile, Jean-Claude Juncker, one of the EU presidents, has been pushing for mandatory migrant quotas. And this is a huge power grab, if he succeeds, by the European Union. And basically that would mean the EU and Brussels would say to Hungary, Poland, and these other Eastern European nations that are reluctant to take on thousands of Muslims, they'd turn to them and say, well, you have to take 10, 20,000 immigrants. But obviously that power grab has not gone down very well, and there'll be a bit of a tussle there. But it shows just how much EU nations have lost control of their own borders to Brussels.
And your top story this week?
Top story this week, I'd like to go back to that other crisis that we've not talked about quite so much in recent weeks, the economic crisis. Now, where we kind of left that about a month or so ago was that one of the solutions, or one of the big solutions that Europe is pushing towards to stop this from happening again, is to develop a common EU tax and a common EU treasury, or Eurozone tax and Eurozone treasury. And there have been a few things this week that highlight that this is moving forward. So Jean-Claude Juncker, who the EU president that we spoke about a couple of minutes ago, his commission has been putting together plans to deepen the union, to create a common Eurozone treasury. And so this treasury would build out of the European Stability Mechanism. That's one of the EU's bailout funds that's responsible for keeping countries afloat. And they're trying to expand basically what they've already put in place and make it much more like government institutions. So some kind of tax, they haven't unveiled the details on that, and then some kind of pan-EU spending. And just to quote a couple of people who in the past few days or weeks have come out in support of that, Klaus Regling, he is the head of the European Stability Mechanism. He has called for this, and just a quick quote from an article, it says he has joined a clamor of voices in Brussels who are pushing for member states to cede sovereignty in a bid to establish a full-blown fiscal union across the continent. Another gentleman who's done this is Benoît Corrier. He is the French executive board member of the European Central Bank, and he's been pushing strongly for this and calling for a treasury of the euro area. There are people calling for, and I believe this was Regling, who's calling for a new chamber on the European Parliament that would just be a Eurozone chamber. So the Eurozone would have its own parliament, its own treasury. So these are people calling very practically for a super state. And Jean-Claude Juncker is heading up plans to move towards that. And the article in the Trumpet Weekly that talks about this is one from Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, called Father of the Euro Fears EU Superstate by the Back Door. And this quote's from Ottmar Issing, who is somebody who wants an EU superstate, but he wants it to be done democratically. And so he is basically warning that a lot of politicians are working on making this happen on the quiet, behind the scenes, and without the democratic accountability that he wants.
Well, Europe certainly hasn't been known for its democratic accountability. In order to make the Eurozone work, they need more political power, and they recognize that. But for them to actually do this the way that, say, this Issing is advocating, that's a really messy process, right? Democracy is messy. It's difficult to get all of these different European countries on board with something like that. So the way that these guys are going about it is probably the only way it's going to happen, isn't it?
Right, yeah. You've got to think back, I think it was 2005-ish, around there, you had France and the Netherlands. These are two of the big core members of the Eurozone, both voted no in referenda to the European Constitution. So just about every time the European Union pushes for more power, more centralized power, more steps towards a super state, when that's put to the vote and when that's put to a democratic system, the people just about always vote no. And you can see that just, I mean, really, taxation and democracy are fundamentally combined. If you look at how democracy came about in the Western world, it was through a process of controlling taxation. And just even the way then that they're pushing this, the EU having the power to raise a tax on financial transactions, say, doesn't sound very threatening. It doesn't sound like a big step towards the super state. Probably the vast majority of people would be thinking, well, I don't own shares. I'm not a big trader on the stock exchange. That's not going to affect me. And it absolutely will, but they're going after these tax powers in very little areas, as a small beginning, in ways that won't raise many hackles. And it's a deceitful process, and it's one that's not at all democratic.
I just want to read a quote from this Ambrose Evans Pritchard article that you're citing. It would require referenda across Europe and a 2/3 majority in both houses of the German parliament. And this fella says the chances of political union are close to zero. Ambrose Evans Pritchard says if Europe were to jump the gun and force the pace of integration, this would lead to a rogue plenipotentiary with unbridled powers over sensitive issues of national life. It's a really strong statement. If they keep on doing this, they're going to end up with a dramatically different political situation within Europe.
Exactly. If you have a European government that has decided for itself it has the power to raise tax, and that's not done, like you say, through those you know, 2/3 majority in referenda, except, well, then what other powers can it award itself? Where does it stop?
Right.
And the power to raise taxes is the most fundamental power of a democratic government, or any government.
And there have been, as you alluded to, significant problems when you've had taxation without representation. And I think the people of Europe really do recognize that they don't have the representation that they really should be having. Well, these stories that we're talking about are in this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is a report that we produce every week with the most significant stories from around the world. I encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. You can find it online at thetrumpet.com. Coming up next, we're going to look at important news from Asia and America, and later on in the program, our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We will be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week, and we're going to turn now to Jeremiah Jacques with the overview from Asia.
Russia is building a drone submarine that's designed to launch nuclear weapons against U.S. harbors and coastal cities. That is according to a report by the Pentagon that was released this week. And this Doomsday Sub, as it's nicknamed, is still a few years from completion, but the experts say that it will be armed with nuclear warheads up to 10 megatons in size. So just one megaton is dozens of times larger than those bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So it's a serious development there. And then in Japan, Shinzo Abe was reelected as the leader of the ruling party. That's the Liberal Democratic Party. And this means that he will very likely remain Japan's prime minister for another 3-year term, and that he will likely continue his push toward Japan becoming a full-fledged military power once again.
Well, Jeremiah, after hearing about a 10-megaton nuclear bomb on a Russian sub off of America's coast, I'm really wondering what your top story from Asia is this week.
Well, that story is still a few years from completion, but the big story is one that's happening right now, and that is that Russia and China are marching together against a common adversary, the United States. That's the title of a really insightful analysis written this week by Mr. Artyom Lukin. He's a professor at Russia's Far Eastern Federal University. And Lukin sheds some light on the burgeoning Russia-China relationship that really confirms a lot of what the Trumpet has said about that relationship over the last few years. In recent months, both Russia and China have held massive military parades that commemorate their victories in World War II. And while most world leaders chose to sit out of those parades, Vladimir Putin decided to attend the Chinese one, and the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, decided to attend the Russian one. And Mr. Lukin says that these parades and the Russo-Chinese relationship in general are really feeding a new trend of historic revisionism that's happening in both nations. They're rewriting World War II history to downplay the role of the United States and Britain and to glorify the role that Russia and China played in defeating Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. I'll just read a section from Mr. Lukin's article here. It says, "The victory in World War II has always been seen in Russia as achieved primarily through Russian efforts, but with the help of America and Great Britain. But Russia's official discourse is now palpably changing, with China replacing the Western allies as the second most important contributor to the outcome of the war. The new interpretation of history says it was the Soviet Union that made the decisive contribution to the defeat of Germany in Europe, while China overcame Imperial Japan in Asia." And this is just gross historic revisionism, especially the part about China being the main player to defeat Japan. The article continues, "Xi's participation in the Victory Day celebrations in Moscow and Putin's visit to Beijing consolidate this new interpretation of history with the obvious aim of strengthening solidarity between the two countries in opposition to the West." And Mr. Lukin concludes his article saying this, "The new addition of Sino-Russian alignment is unlikely to rupture anytime soon. Even though Russia and China have their share of disagreements and competing interests, they have no doubts about their main adversary, the United States. And the entente between Russia and China will only grow stronger." So this really just confirms a lot of what the Trumpet has long said. In the May-June issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet last year, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, said, "China has made clear that they support Putin over its annexation of Crimea." And then Mr. Fleury goes on, "When these Asian nations, extremely powerful nuclear-armed countries, begin to show solidarity with each other regarding moves like that, what does that portend for the world? I tell you, it is woe to the world. It will cause many serious problems, and it's going to affect everyone." So this new analysis that Mr. Lukin wrote and that we've published in the Trumpet Weekly just really confirms all that Mr. Fleury said back in the May-June issue there.
Well, you mentioned what the Trumpet has been saying, but Herbert W. Armstrong was saying that even decades before that, based on biblical prophecies of this unification between Russia and China, the two main powers within Asia actually coming together and aligning with one another in a powerful way in the time ahead. And it's remarkable to just watch this developing right in front of our eyes.
Yes, it really is. And Mr. Armstrong made that forecast at a time when it seemed very unlikely, given both the undeveloped nature of China and the heated border disputes, especially in the early 60s between Russia and China. They really hated each other. But he said, despite what you see right now, these two are both going to be powerful and they're both going to come together. And now that is a reality.
Another important dimension to this is the weakening of the United States to the point where they would feel so emboldened to be so upfront about their animosity toward the United States. That really hasn't been the case all that much since, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union. They've been fairly quiet until recent years.
That's right. Nature abhors a vacuum, and that's true with human nature as well. And so with the United States declining, these other powers are very quick to fill the void that America has left.
Well, thank you for bringing that story to us. We will turn now to Anglo-America. For that, we'll ask Robert, what are the overview of headlines for Anglo-America this week?
Well, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said that the U.S. must be prepared for a, quote, large Armageddon-scale cyber attack that could, quote, debilitate the entire U.S. infrastructure. And his warning came on Thursday at an annual conference of intelligence community members here in the United States. He said that the cyber threats to U.S. national and economic security are increasing in frequency, scale, sophistication, and severity of impact. So this is a very alarming statement that Mr. Clapper was making. This, of course, is something that we've been warning about for a long time here at The Trumpet as well. Back in 1999, America's reliance on technology is an Achilles heel. In other news this week, Americans get a D in science. So says a new Pew Research Center report. Pew quizzed a representative sample of U.S. adults on a number of areas, geology, physics, astronomy, other topics. They asked them 12 questions, and the test takers gave their responses, and they found that on average they scored 66% correct. And the most disturbing thing about this survey is that the questions were really, really simple. Things like, the Earth has three layers, the crust, the mantle, and the core. Which is the hottest? The core. Simple science.
I knew that one.
Right. What is the difference between astronomy, the study of the stars, and astrology, you know, using the stars to make predictions, you know, et cetera? And majorities of Americans in some of these simple questions didn't know the answers correctly. So doesn't look good in terms of science for America.
I was helping my daughter study for seventh grade science test the other day, and it was pretty humbling to me. She was studying about leaves and photosynthesis and plant reproduction, and I learned an entirely new vocabulary looking at this science textbook. So my seventh grade daughter is a whole lot farther ahead than I am.
Well, it is true when you've been out of it for a while.
So the top story from Anglo-America this week.
Yeah, the top story this week comes from the World Bank's chief economist. He warned that the Federal Reserve would cause global panic and turmoil if it begins to raise interest rates in the next few weeks. So if you remember, the Federal Reserve has had interest rates stuck at zero, between 0% and 0.25% for the last 7 years. This was a result of that 2008-2009 economic crisis where Wall Street practically imploded and fell apart, and the Federal Reserve came rushing in with billions and billions of dollars worth of printed money to prop things up. Well, here we are now 7 years later, and the Federal Reserve has kept putting off and putting off and putting off raising interest rates because they said they would only begin raising interest rates when they thought the economy had recovered enough that it could handle it. Now, they put it off so long, though, now that economists are warning, if you don't hurry up and start raising rates, when the next crisis strikes, you're going to have no ammunition left to fight that crisis. You won't be able to slash interest rates and make it easier for people to borrow more money and get the economy going again. So we appear to be at this turning point in the economy where the Fed feels like it's compelled to raise interest rates, even though the economy might not be able to handle it. So it's kind of like at the lesser of two evils. We're at this point now. And the World Bank chief economist is saying, don't do it. We can't handle it right now. And this is very disturbing because the Fed has said that if it raises rates, it'll only be a fraction of a percent. It's not like we're even going to go and raise rates by 1%. They've said if we raise interest rates, it'll be between 0.1% to 0.25%. So maybe a quarter of a point we might raise rates. And this has the World Bank's chief economist up in arms and saying, if you do this, you could derail the whole global economy. And he pointed to emerging markets in particular and saying they can't handle it. There is so much debt out there, and so much of their debt is denominated in dollars. They borrowed in dollars, but they earn their income in their own local currencies, that if interest rates in America even go up a little bit, it could cause the dollar to strengthen in value short term, and they won't be able to pay those debts. They won't be able to pay those debts. He's saying that if you raise interest rates, it'll make the dollar stronger. It'll be harder for America our exporters to produce. And he said, America's economy is completely addicted to debt. If you go back to 2008, you see the world's economists saying this was a debt bubble. Remember the subprime mortgage debt bubble, too much debt. The system couldn't handle it. The Wall Street banks had too much of it. We needed to retrench. We needed to pay off this debt. None of that ever happened. When the Federal Reserve slashed interest rates to zero and started printing money, all it did was encourage more debt. And if we look at the world, our debt levels are higher than ever again. The federal government in America has $18 trillion in debt, you know, $10 trillion pre-crisis. If you look at virtually every sector in America besides mortgage debt, we've increased the amount of debt. It just moved. Instead of having the mortgage debt, now Americans have subprime auto debt. Now we have subprime student loan debt. Now we have subprime credit card debt out there. And only the numbers are bigger than they were back in 2008. So a lot of analysts out there, they're looking and some of them say, well, yeah, we have more debt and it's a problem. But look, our interest payments are so low. We can handle it. The Federal Reserve, the federal government, for example, our debt's now $18 trillion, but our interest payments are about the same as they were before the crisis. And they say, see, we can handle it. No problem. Well, the question rises, yeah, we can handle it today, but what happens when interest rates start rising? It starts compounding the effects of debt, and we have more debt than ever.
So you mentioned the effect on foreign investors, but all of the debt that you're describing, basically it affects every single sector of the American economy, basically every American, any amount of debt that they've got, it's going to become more expensive.
That's right. Anything that isn't a fixed rate is going up. So credit card debt, that could go up very easily. Auto loans could go up very easily. Corporate debt, this is probably where the biggest danger is. We have, if you look at corporate debt today, it's just through the roof. And these are businesses that take out loans and maybe they mature after 2 years or 3 years. Well, where are rates going to be in 2 or 3 years? If the Fed starts raising now, it could be a lot higher. And we've already seen this in the junk bond market, where interest rates have jumped 2, 3, 4% just over the last couple of months. When these companies have to refinance their debt, they're going to be in serious trouble.
It reminds me of that Bank of International Settlements warning just from, a few weeks back, where they were talking about how we've run out of lifeboats. And that's exactly the case. I mean, the interest rate, that's probably the biggest, the most reliable lifeboat. And we've been without one really for several years now.
Yeah, absolutely. Central banks can't cut interest rates any further. Where do you go below zero? Do you start paying people interest on their money? Like, this is something that doesn't work. You can't find this. We've made the point before. It doesn't exist in the textbooks because nobody has thought anything like this could happen. But here's what I find really disturbing about this. The Federal Reserve came out this week. The president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve, the branch up in Minneapolis, came out and said, you know what we need to do to bring stability? The government needs to borrow more money and spend more money. This was his argument. He said, look, we're at a point where we need to raise interest rates. This is going to cause dislocation in the markets. There's no doubt about this, he said, but we have to do it. So how can we mitigate this problem? And he says, since we're going to be raising interest rates slowly, the best way to mitigate this is for the federal government to go into debt markets and borrow more money and spend more money and get that juice into the economy to keep things going. I mean, look where we're at in this economy, that we need to be going. The only thing keeping it growing is increasing debt. I mean, that is a huge warning sign that something isn't right. I mean, these leaders we have out there, shouldn't they be thinking to themselves, what kind of economy are we, what are we driving here when the only way to keep things going, keep things stable, as he called it, is to go out and borrow more money?
Well, that's been their solution all along, hasn't it? The problem is debt and the solution is debt.
It really has. And then they wonder, why do we keep having problems?
Thanks for that report. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. The article that Robert is talking about here is in our free weekly report, The Trumpet Weekly. You can get a subscription to this on thetrumpet.com. And all the stories that we're talking about in the program today are in this report. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That is coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll begin with Brent.
This is from the Times of Israel, and it's entitled PM, that is Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he says, EU vote to label Israel settlement products echoes Nazi era. So there was a vote in the EU Parliament on Thursday, and they voted to make the distinction between the West Bank and Israel, and that mainly concerns goods produced, those that are produced inside the West Bank and those that are produced inside Israel proper. This is something that the EU has wanted for a long time, and it passed by a resounding vote of 525-70. So most in Europe, government officials want those goods coming out of Israel from the West Bank to be notified or labeled as such. And obviously, you know, if they're labeled as such, they're trying to encourage people not to buy those goods. They believe people should have the choice of determining whether to purchase something, whether it was produced in Israel or in Israel. I mean, in the West Bank, sorry. The thing that with this, they're trying to encourage the peace process in a way, or at least a two-state solution. But looking at the situation on the ground and how it affects things, you'll see that it's going to hurt the everyday Palestinian more than it will Israel. Israel doesn't just produce things in the West Bank. Most of their economy takes place in Israel proper. Yet in the West Bank, you have 20,000 Palestinians that are employed by Jewish companies. These are the people that are going to lose their jobs from this. Already in the West Bank, you have 23% unemployment. So, you know, the people that are going to be hurting are the everyday Palestinians through this.
Amazing stuff. Richard.
In about a week, the Pope will leave for his long-awaited U.S. trip. And we have a good article to get you ready for that in this week's Trumpet Weekly from Agency France Press called Pope Francis Prepares for Most Political Trip Yet. He'll be visiting Cuba for a few days, then he'll come to the U.S. And you'll see him very critical of the U.S. economy, basically calling for bigger government, more spending on social issues. He'll call for America to do more for Mexican immigrants. And of course, most of those immigrants are Catholic. He will talk about the Middle East. And other reports suggest that he's quite keen on the Iran deal and that he may talk about that. But most importantly, at the U.S. Congress, when he's talking to the president, when he's at the UN, he will call for a new approach to the world economy and society, as one economics professor put it. He will trash the current world's economic system. And as we just heard from Rob, there are big problems with that. But he'll push a solution that looks very Catholic. And then finally, here are some comments from America's ambassador to the Vatican on this upcoming trip. He said that the Pope and Mr. Obama are on the same page on poverty and climate change. He said that when it comes to the differences about birth control, abortion, same-sex marriage, that kind of thing, he said, there are differences. I don't think that's where they're going to put all their energies when they sit down one-to-one. So they're going to focus more on reforming the economic system. And then finally, when it comes to talking about crowds and media attention, this ambassador said that the Secret Service, who's organizing the security, see this as the biggest event ever. And apparently they're anticipating huge crowds and just a lot of media attention on this trip. And the ambassador said, this is mammoth.
That's a lot of information about a trip that has yet to take place. Definitely something that we will be keeping our eyes on very closely in the weeks ahead. It is extraordinary just how much what there's a confluence of state and church in that particular church. And going on, we'll move now to Jeremiah.
Russia has surprised the world with its return to great power status. Much has been made in recent years of Russia's demographic and economic problems, but we've got a piece in the Trumpet Weekly by Jonathan Alderman saying that despite these problems, Russia has reestablished itself as a great power in large part by courting authoritarian and corrupt regimes all over the planet. Russia has reacquired Crimea, South Ossetia there in Georgia, Abkhazia, and part of Ukraine's left bank, sort of. And authoritarian leaders all around the world really celebrate Russia's expansion and its acquiring of all these territories. The reason why is because these leaders have their own expansionist aspirations, and they like the precedent that Russia is setting. The Sunni Arab leaders, nationalist leaders in European nations like Hungary and Latvia, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who we talked about earlier, And then leaders in Argentina and Brazil, leaders in China and Russia, they all support Vladimir Putin's Russia. And this means that despite Russia's economic and demographic problems, it is once again a great global power.
Just never would have expected to hear that at the end of the Cold War unless you understood biblical prophecy.
That's right.
And now finally on to Robert Morley.
The Daily Beast is reporting that more than 50 intelligence analysts working out of the U.S. military's Central Command have come forward and formally complained in their reports concerning the Islamic State that they were being inappropriately altered by senior officials. The Pentagon's inspector general has taken this very seriously. He's opened up an investigation into the alleged manipulation of intelligence. But the fact that so many intelligence officials are complaining, that there's 50 of them, is suggesting, at least according to the Daily Beast, that there are deep-rooted systemic problems in the upper levels of the intelligence community. Two senior analysts signed a written complaint sent to the Defense Department Inspector General alleging that these reports, some of which were briefed to President Obama, portrayed the terror groups as being weak and weaker than the analysts believe they are. And this is quite damaging to America. Once again, we see the credibility of America's intelligence agencies being questioned before the whole world. When President Obama came into power, he pledged to basically rebuild that trust in the agencies that had been destroyed, you know, supposedly destroyed under President Bush and the weapons of mass destruction. But here we are again with these types of allegations saying that the material that's being pushed through is not actually what those analysts are finding.
So who's doing the altering?
Well, according to the Daily Beast and according to the allegations by these 50 intelligence analysts, it's the upper level echelon within the intelligence community. So those people that are reporting to President Obama. So the big question is, according to the Daily Beast, are these senior analysts, are they altering the data because they want it to conform to the President Obama's narrative that we're winning the war against ISIS, that we're winning the war against these, you know, junior varsity league type organizations?
Political motivations rather than seeking the truth.
Unfortunately, that's what it appears to be.
I just wanted to mention one story that's in this week's Trumpet Weekly. Immigration is obviously a huge topic, not just in Europe, but in the U.S. right now. And on the pro side of the argument are those who say, hey, we're a nation of immigrants. Where would we be without immigrants? And the president says that immigrants strengthen the country. Well, the Center of Immigration Studies has just come out with a report based on new census reports that I found pretty amazing. Of legal immigrant households with children, 72% access one or more welfare programs compared to 52% of native households. That's the language in the report. It was kind of shocking to me. It should be shocking, really, that 52% of Native American households, not Native American, but Native households in America are on welfare, 52%. But nearly three quarters of legal immigrant households are getting financial assistance from the government. This is a quote from the center's director of research and the author of this report. His name is Stephen Camarota. He said this: three-fourths of immigrant households using welfare are headed by legal immigrants. Legal immigration is supposed to benefit the country, yet so many legal immigrants are not able to support themselves or their children. This raises important questions about the selection criteria used for legal immigration. It's a valid point. But on top of that, the data that they collected from the Census Bureau, it shows that of illegal immigrant households with children, 87% are on at least one welfare program. Almost 9 in 10 of these families who have violated America's immigration laws in order to come into the country are getting welfare. Now, there are a lot of problems and potential problems associated with immigration, but just looking at it purely from an economic standpoint, what is happening in the United States right now with its immigration is coming at a high cost to the United States. I am Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories we've talked about on the program today are in this week's report. Send us your thoughts or questions by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. We're all over social media. Follow us on Twitter at thetrumpet_com. Facebook and Google Plus, we can be found by searching for Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to our panel, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
You're welcome, Greg.
Have a great day.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Dale Carnegie. Most of the important things in the world have been accomplished by people who have kept on trying when there seemed to be no hope at all. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.